you, if this were in effect for yesterday's midterm election, what effect do you think it would have had on the governor's race in Florida? We're talking about 1.4 million Floridians getting the right to vote. Bush won in 2000 with, what, 500 votes. President Trump won with something like 116,000 votes. You're talking 1.4 million Floridians now will have their right to vote restored.
That's a great question. And you know how I answer that, Amy? You know, like I told people in the past, when I was arrested by the police, they didn't ask me if I was Democrat or Republican. And when I appeared before that judge, he didn't ask me that either. And so it's pretty hard to say. There are studies on both sides that would say it would break either way. But this is what I do say. If 1.4 million returned citizens were able to vote yesterday, they would vote for the candidate that spoke to their issues. One of the things that we have really stressed in Florida is that we don't lean left, we don't lean right. We lean straight forward into the issues that impact people that have been impacted by the criminal justice system, people with felony convictions. And so if you were to ask me how folks would have voted, the only thing I would have could tell you is that they would have voted for the person that spoke more precisely and clearly to the issues that impact them as a
returning
citizen.
Desmond Mead, we have to leave it there. President of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, I hope we can come down and cover you in 2020 when you vote chairman of Floridians for a Fair Democracy. He spearheaded Amendment 4, which has reenfranchised 1.4 million Floridians. Also, this breaking news, Georgia's 6th Congressional District, AP has just projected Lucy McBath has defeated incumbent Republican Congressmember Karen Handel. She's a gun control activist whose 17-year-old black son, Jordan Davis, was killed by a white man when he opened fire on his car. That does it for our show. A special thanks to Katrina Vandenhoevel, publisher of The Nation, and Rashad Robinson, executive director of Color of Change. Happy birthday to John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Again, to watch our six-hour broadcast last night, go to democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
I don't know if I know all the words or not, but I'm going to try to sing it for you.
In celebration of our 50th anniversary, KBOO is teaming up with the Mississippi Records Music and Film Series. KBOO will be hosting Wild in the Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. A freaked out 60s exploitation movie, Wild in the Streets follows Max Frost and the Troopers, a psychedelic rock band that managed to take over the United States after the voting age is lowered to 16. The new regime legalizes all drugs, puts everyone over 30 into acid re-education camps, and creates a new hippie fascist utopia. Again, that's Wild in the Streets on Wednesday, November 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. More information can be found at KBOO.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is a little past 5, and time for KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we have Native National News.
We talk about Measures 105 and 106.
And in international news, Project Censored Afghanistan.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 7th, 2018. I'm Carly Meisberger.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Measures 103 and 104 were soundly defeated by Oregon voters yesterday. These measures were pretty universally opposed by progressive groups in the state. Measure 103 would have prevented the enactment or increase of any state or local tax, fee, or assessment on the sale of groceries. But even though it was painted as a grocery tax, it was actually a constitutional amendment that would lock in tax loopholes for large corporations. Measure 104 was about requiring a supermajority in the state legislature for any bill that would raise taxes. an impressive coalition of more than 100 organizations organized to oppose Measure 104. They ranged from the environmental group 350 PDX to the houseless advocacy group Right to Survive.
Progressive candidate Jennifer McGuirk has won the election for Multnomah County Auditor, defeating Scott Learn with 55% of the vote. She indicated that her top three priorities would be to start a long overdue audit of conditions in country jails, an audit of housing and homeless services from the perspective of people attempting to access services, and an audit of conditions in adult care homes for seniors and people with disabilities. She also promised to bolster our good government hotline and create an organizational ombudsman for employees facing harassment and discrimination.
Andrea Williams, the head of CAUSA Oregon, joined KBOO's Janka Soderberg at... Oh, excuse me, we are actually still waiting on the audio for that one, so we are going to go on to the midheads. Democrat Stacey Abrams for the governor's race in Georgia has stated that she will refuse to concede, meaning that she has decided not to close the race until all of the votes in Georgia have been counted. Abrams says that she vows to wait for them all. Abrams told supporters at her election night party that they would have, quote, a chance to do a do-over in her race against Republican Brian Kemp, implying a runoff in conclusion. Kemp has a very narrow lead in the vote count, but it is still possible the race could go to a runoff. In Georgia, a race goes to an automatic runoff if neither candidate receives more than 50% of the vote. Early returns showed Kemp running up large margins across rural and small-town Georgia, but parts of the metro area of Atlanta, where Stacey Abrams' strength is concentrated, has yet to be reported. Some of those Atlanta area counties had extended voting hours for some precincts to accommodate the crowds and compensate for problems.
Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has introduced a new ordinance to further control street protests. Wheeler is branding his proposal as the Public Safety Ordinance, and this would give him broad new powers to limit how Portland citizens may express their opinions in public. A public hearing on the ordinance is scheduled for tomorrow, November 8th, at 2:15 at Portland City Hall. The ACLU has called Wheeler's proposal clearly unconstitutional. For more, KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with the anti-fascist activist Star Stauffer.
Portland police have been long criticized for their provocative attitude towards protesters. Mayor Ted Wheeler and our Chief of Police Danielle Otlaw seem intent on continuing this tradition. In explaining police-induced injuries after the August 4th protest, Chief Otlaw explained on the Lars Larson show that, quote, "I come with the intention to fight, and then you get mad because I kicked your butt." Anti-fascist activist Star Stauffer gave public testimony on this issue at City Hall this morning, and I caught up with them just outside of chambers.
My name is Star Stauffer. I'm just an anti-fascist resident that stands up against bigots, racists, and fascists.
And your testimony today was about Portland police.
Yes, and the protest ordinance that's going to be voted on tomorrow by City Council that Wheeler's trying to pass. My major complaint is directly aimed at Danielle Outlaw and mainly their actions on August 4th, where they instigated an altercation between anti-fascist residents that had shown up to stand against white supremacists who had shown up to antagonize the community. And during that altercation instigated by Portland police, several members of the community were seriously injured and a couple of them nearly killed as a result of that instigated attack.
So your observation is that Portland police are not really neutral?
They are not neutral. Reports have come out in the past that shows Portland police target those that they view as, quote, Antifa or leftists or anarchists. And They have been asked to describe what those folks would even look like and have failed to be able to do so. And so quite often they show up and antagonize or instigate an attack with those they deem to be leftist opposing protesters against those that show up representing quote-unquote patriots, fascists, neo-Nazis, and white supremacists.
Who do you think is in charge of the Portland Police Department?
Danielle Outlaw.
She runs it.
She runs it. I think Wheeler has little to no incentive to try to gain any sort of control over this police force. And she has stated, even on Lars Larson, that she tells him how it's going to be, and he just goes along with that. She went in and told him how she was going to start handling the protests, and she said straight up he didn't argue that. He just kind of backed down from her. She's disgraceful.
Do we have civilian control over our police in Portland?
I guess it depends on what kind of civilian you are in this particular current fight that we're in.
Yeah. And for our listeners who may want to get involved, do you have any advice for them?
Show up. Support your women of color that are taking leadership in this community. Show up and support your fellow community members who are standing against fascism and white supremacy. Show up and support family members that are grieving loved ones lost because of police violence and violence due to white extremism. Just show up.
Okay, thanks for talking to KBOO.
Thank you very much.
That was anti-fascist activist Star Stauffer. They told us that Portland police are not neutral in their street enforcement. They target citizens thought to have left-leaning political beliefs while protecting white nationalists, fascists, and neo-Nazis. That Mayor Wheeler, who is commissioner in charge of police, has little motivation in gaining control of the Portland Police Department, and that Chief Outlaw calls the shots. The Portland City Council will hold a public meeting on Mayor Wheeler's protest safety ordinance tomorrow at City Hall at 2:15. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Kitchen Table Conversations at 6, then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is mostly clear skies with a low of 37 degrees. Today in history, L. Douglas Wilder became the first African-American elected to governor of a state since Reconstruction on November 7, 1989, when he was elected governor of Virginia. The quote of the day is from Sadie Delaney. Life is short, and it's up to you to make it sweet.
Ayanna Presley won her House race in Massachusetts' 7th District, becoming the state's first Black woman elected to Congress. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has won in New York's 14th Congressional District. Rashida Tlaib has won Michigan's 13th Congressional District. And Ilhan Omar has won Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. They are the first Muslim women in Congress. Rashida Tlaib is the first Palestinian American in Congress, and Ilhan Omar is the first Somali American in Congress. Arkansas has approved a minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. Laura Kelly has defeated Chris Kobach in Kansas. Kobach is the instigator of the infamous cross-check voter database, which disenfranchised millions of voters across the country based on false matches with people with similar names. He was also the author of Arizona's SB 1070, known as the Papers, Please Law, which allowed the racist sheriff Joe Arpaio and others to engage in racial profiling of people who look Latino. And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
And Kamrick in for Antonio Gonzalez. Two women who drew heavily on their Native heritage during their campaigns are headed to Congress following Tuesday's election. Democrat Deborah Holland from New Mexico's Laguna Pueblo handily beat her Republican and Libertarian opponents in that state's first congressional district. Speaking to supporters after securing her win, she recognized the historic moment.
70 years ago, Native Americans right here in New Mexico couldn't vote. Can you believe that? Growing up in my mother's Pueblo household and as a 35th generation New Mexican, I never imagined a world where I would be represented by someone who looks like me. Tonight, New Mexico, you are sending one of the very first Native American women to Congress.
This is Holland's first publicly elected office. She earned a law degree from the University of New Mexico and chaired the state Democratic Party. In an interview election night, she said she welcomes the chance to be a voice in Congress for tribes all across the country.
I'm grateful that I understand the fundamentals of tribal law and tribal issues, tribal sovereignty, and so forth. So, you know, they can start at a higher level with me. I'll be able to hopefully help them also to have a voice in Congress.
New Mexico could also send another Native woman to Congress. Republican Yvette Harrell is enrolled Cherokee but has barely mentioned her Native heritage. She holds a slim lead in the state's second congressional district. Several news outlets called the race in her favor, but the Secretary of State's office said 4,000 absentee ballots remain to be counted in Doña Ana County. Also, about another 4,000 additional absentee ballots have been tabulated, and the results of those will be posted Wednesday. The news site nmpolitics.net reports less than 2,000 votes separate Harrell from Democrat Xochitl Torres-Small. In Kansas, Cherise Davids, a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, made history when she was elected as the state's first openly LGBT member in Congress. Along with Holland, she will be one of the first Native American women in Congress as well. The Kansas City Star reports Davids defeated GOP incumbent Kevin Yoder to represent the state's third congressional district. In her victory speech, Davids said too many people haven't felt seen or heard.
And I've said this before, I hear you, and I see you, because you deserve that. We all deserve that.
Davids promised that things will be different when she goes to Washington.
Because the time for people to not be heard and not be seen and not be listened to or represented well changes now.
The Star reports David's campaign got a boost from first-time voters and volunteers spurred to get involved following the election of Donald Trump. On the Navajo Nation, Jonathan Nez overwhelmingly won election for president. He beat opponent Joe Shirley Jr. to replace current president Russell Begay. There remain complaints about widespread ballot shortages. It's unclear how Navajo election officials plan to deal with the complaints. But Nez has nearly twice as many votes as Shirley in unofficial results, so there's little chance the outcome will change. And in Utah, after court-ordered redistricting and a residency challenge, Navajo Democrat Willie Gray Eyes handily beat his opponent to give the San Juan Utah County Commission its first Navajo majority for the first time in history. The Salt Lake Tribune reports the U.S. Department of Justice sent a watchdog to the county to observe the election. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is by Odawi Law Group, provider of Indian Law Solutions, and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite System.
From Northern Minnesota, Red Lake.
In 2016, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit upheld a lower court ruling that favored the 2015 net neutrality rules put in place by the Obama administration's Federal Communications Commission. Several internet providers took their fight to the U.S. Supreme Court, hoping the court would throw out the ruling. As such, there are many states that are putting laws on the book that form their own net neutrality rules. Additionally, 21 states and the District of Columbia have filed a lawsuit against the FCC over its repeal of the net neutrality rules. Newly minted Justice Brett Kavanaugh did not take part in Monday's ruling because the appeal came from his former court. Senator Ed Markey touted Monday's ruling as a victory. In an email to NBC, Markey said, quote, "The FCC's open internet order is regarded as settled law by the courts, and that is what today's decision by the Supreme Court really means. This is an important win for the internet and all Americans who support strong net neutrality rules," unquote.
Andrea Williams, the head of CAUSA Oregon, joined KBOO's Jenka Soderberg at the No on 105 and No on 106 party last night in downtown Portland.
We have over 500 endorsers, from law enforcement to businesses to civil rights groups, because we believe that racial profiling is wrong. And we know that trust is the foundation of good policing. And when federal immigration works hand in hand with local police, many immigrants will become too fearful to come forward and report a crime, or if they've been a witness, to share that information. And so at the end of the day, that hurts all of us. And we hope that Oregonians will agree with us to defeat this measure.
And do you think that the rhetoric that's being put out on a national level, the anti-immigrant fervor from the White House and others, is playing a part in how close this measure has become here in Oregon?
Sure. It doesn't help that the Trump administration, Immigration Customs Enforcement, and so many others nationally are setting an extremely anti-immigrant, hateful tone. And, you know, when those types of forces are working against you, it makes it even more challenging. But, the No on 105 campaign has really been about that more aspirational version of who we are as Americans, who we are as Oregonians. And we hope that Oregonians will agree with us this election, that we believe in fairness. We believe in looking out for our neighbors. And we believe that this 31-year-old anti-racial profiling law has been working well for our state.
And what role does the immigrant community play here in Oregon? I understand that there's actually a net tax benefit from immigrants here in Oregon.
Immigrants have contributed to our state for generations, and this current generation of immigrants is no different. Immigrant communities are more likely to start small businesses, which are the lifeblood of our state economy. They contribute taxes. They start jobs. They start companies. The immigrant community is very vital to our economy. And if this law were to be stripped away, it would greatly damage our progress in the state.
And how would it affect Oregon's economy?
You know, there's actually a study that we did on our website that it's posted on the No on 105 campaign, and I can't remember all the results, but several national think tanks studied, you know, what kind of impact this would have if our anti-racial profiling law was taken away, and it estimates that there would be a huge detriment to our economy, to our jobs, to our tax base.
That was Andrea Williams of CAUSA Oregon. Next, we have Grayson Dempsey, the head of NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon, talking about Measure 106.
This is Jenka Soderberg. I am here at the election night party with the No on 105 and No on 106 campaigns. And could you introduce yourself and talk about why you are involved in the No on 106 campaign?
My name is Grayson Dempsey. I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Oregon, and we've been part of the No Cuts to Care campaign since it launched in July. We believe that it is a basic right to have access to the full range of reproductive health care, including abortion. And we're worried specifically about this measure because it disproportionately impacted people who already faced the highest barriers to care. So this is this is an issue that really goes against our core values and our mission, and we've been working hard to defeat ever since we had about it, you know, ever since it was IP1 and we knew that this was going to be coming on November's ballot.
How did it make it onto the ballot in a state that has repeatedly confirmed and reconfirmed women's right to safe and legal abortion?
You know, here in Oregon, we have a system in which we have sort of easy entry onto the ballot. So the requirements to get onto the ballot require a number of signatures that is really less than about 1% of the population. This was a volunteer-led effort, led mainly through volunteers at churches. And they were able, in the time that they were collecting signatures, to collect just barely enough to get onto the ballot. So it was something that was hard for us to be watching prior to the signature filing deadline because it was a volunteer effort. There wasn't a lot of transparency into their collection methods, but certainly we were ready to launch our campaign just as soon as they filed signatures.
And what's been the response that you've gotten in canvassing and in going around Oregon talking to people about the women's right to have their health care and to be able to have a free and legal abortion in the state?
You know, talking to people at the doors and really all the ways in which this campaign has reached voters has really affirmed for me that Oregonians share our value, that access to abortion is a right that they don't want to lose. It's been incredible, really, to go out on the doors and be able to have this conversation with voters. I wish we didn't have to be working to defeat this measure, but I do think that for people to remember that we do need to be vigilant, even in a pro-choice state like Oregon, I think it's been incredible to be talking to people about not just sort of politics as usual, but the values that we really hold most dear that are on the ballot with 105 and 106. I'll tell you an anecdote, which is that I just came to this event in an Uber and rode over here and was talking about the election night, and my Uber driver told me her abortion story. And so I do think, and told me she was a no on 106 voter. So I do think that this really gets to the core of how of people's really most dearly held values. And we know that Oregon is a pro-choice state, not only in that it believes in the right to safe and legal abortion, but it believes in the right to health care, and health care certainly for even those who are covered by state-funded health plans, which we've really seen as we've talked to voters this cycle.
Yeah, we've had a number of shows on KABU where people have shared their stories of abortions and going through that process. And now, especially with what has happened at the federal level with the Supreme Court and the hearing of Justice Kavanaugh and him getting confirmed, what role do you think that has played in what people, what women are going through here in Oregon and across the country? But it seems like there is a national threat to the right to legal abortions. And has that had some sort of chilling effect? Has it empowered people? What's been the impact here in Oregon?
I absolutely think that Oregonians are looking at the national landscape and recognizing that the threat to legal abortion is really under greater attack than it has ever been. I think that that's really mobilizing for people who are pro-choice and want to make sure their state is pro-choice. So the conversation I think that's been happening at the national level has been, it's been helpful in sort of bringing that threat home to Oregon. People in Oregon, I think, often feel like those threats that are coming from D.C. won't affect us because we are such a pro-choice state. So to be able to talk about this measure as part of a very extremist agenda to take rights away from women is something that voters understand.
Well, I just want to thank you so much. Again, we've been speaking with the director of NARAL Oregon and the No on 106 campaign. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KABU Radio.
In this Project Censored excerpt, historian Peter Kuznick returns to the discussion of the forthcoming update to his book, The Untold History of the United States. The new material will cover the period from 2012 to 2018. In this excerpt of this week's show, Kuznick addresses issues ranging from Trump and Russia to the prospects for ending the conflict in Syria.
On today's program, we are speaking with historian Peter Kuznick, who is co-author with Oliver Stone of The Untold History of the United States. Before the break, Peter Kuznick, we were talking about Russia, all things Russia, as seems to be in vogue here in the United States. But you touched on something that Chase had asked about earlier when we were talking about the natural resources and the financial control of these kinds of resources. And of course, Afghanistan is the longest war in U.S. history. It also appears to be one of the ones that goes down the memory hole. One wonders if the corporate media remembers necessarily that we are still involved in wars there. You mentioned Trump had sent more troops there which called attention to it. It was estimated in 2010 and then updated a few years later that there's maybe about $1 trillion in untapped mineral deposits in Afghanistan. That number has been elevated to potentially $3 trillion. And let's not forget the opium trade, right? But on top of that, we're talking iron, copper, cobalt, gold, lithium. Afghanistan is one of the poorest countries on the planet in terms of the population, but in terms of resource wealth, it's an amazingly rich place. And that's, of course, also why Russia was trying to get in there during the Cold War. So this also plays into the present with U.S. and Russian relations, does it not?
It does. If we go back, Afghanistan is a really interesting case study. Because, first of all, the insight into Afghanistan's mineral riches actually goes back into the late 19th century and the early 20th century. People should look this up because we've known about Afghanistan's mineral wealth for a very, very long time. But Afghanistan has been one of these political footballs that's been used, exploited. That country is dirt poor. When the U.S. got involved, I think the life expectancy was something like 40 years. I mean, this is a country in which the overall majority of people are illiterate. They live in great poverty. It's always number one or two in the corruption index. It's a very depressing country, and we've done almost nothing to help that. In fact, the corruption is not abated at all. Even still, if you want to get a job as a teacher there, you've got to give at least 5 months of your salary in bribes to get a job as a teacher. And that's not even a well-paying job there in Afghanistan. But if we go back to where this all begins, it's 1979, where you had a pro-Soviet government takes over in Afghanistan. Brzezinski, who was the national security advisor to Carter, sees this as a golden opportunity. And the United States begins to throw money there to work with the Saudis in financing an operation that was run largely in Pakistan to train the Mujahideen, to train Islamic extremists, to train jihadis to overthrow the Afghan government. The University of Nebraska was producing the training manuals. The U.S. was arming them. People like Osama bin Laden and other future leaders of al-Qaeda were involved in much of this operation. And the United States was not concerned that the government there was oppressive. In fact, the thing that they objected to, these mujahideen who we were training, the main thing they objected to was that women were being educated under this new government. That this new government had the audacity to educate women. So the people who we were supporting there, training, arming, supporting, the main grievance was that women were being educated. Their second main grievance was that there had been land reform going on. So we create this army, or help create this army, of jihadis, who then go and try to overthrow the pro-Russian government in Afghanistan. When the Russians are forced to intervene to support the government there, they had hesitated, they didn't want to. Brezhnev thought that they could knock it off pretty quickly. They sent 100,000 troops there, and they're tied down for a decade. It is a disaster for the Soviet Union. But Brzezinski was elated. He was thrilled. He said that now we've given the Soviet Union its own Vietnam. So, and that's, you know, so on what our public pronouncements were, this is terrible. You know, this is the Soviets have invaded another country. But behind the scenes, they were elated. And so this is where it begins. But when the U.S. invades Afghanistan in 2001, Putin and Russia were assisting us. They gave us landing rights. They weren't getting militarily involved, but they did nothing to impede the U.S. operation. In fact, they facilitated it, which was essential in terms of the strategic concerns about landing the troops and the weapons. But the United States has been involved there for 17 years, the longest war in American history, and we're losing ground constantly. Now the Taliban controls more than 70% of the country, whereas just a couple of years ago, the percentage they controlled was far, far lower. So the situation is rapidly deteriorating. Trump, while he was running for office, denounced Afghanistan, that he was going to pull U.S. troops out of Afghanistan. What does he do? He doubles down. He sends thousands of more troops into Afghanistan. And so we saw the same thing happen with Obama. Obama tripled the number of troops in Afghanistan and said that he wanted other alternatives, but the hawks who surrounded him, led by Hillary Clinton, Robert Gates, David Petraeus, McChrystal, they didn't even give him the other options that he was demanding. And so Obama made the same foolhardy gestures and increased American troop strength over 100,000. Trump has now got it back up to 15,000. And who knows what the next step is going to be there. There is no way we're going to win militarily. Fortunately, we're beginning to negotiate somewhat with the Taliban. That's the only way this is going to ever end. And it's still a miserable situation. 1 year in Afghanistan, the United States spent $100 billion on the military side of the operation and $2 billion on sustainable development. It's a country where people can't read. They have a hard time getting people into the military. They don't know about indoor plumbing, and the illiteracy rates are so high, so the turnover rate is astronomical there.
That was an excerpt of Project Censored, speaking with historian Peter Kuznick. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, November 7th, 2018. Here are the main points again. We discussed the election results in Multnomah County. There were big wins for progressives and POC candidates in last night's election. And in international news, we discussed Project Censored in Afghanistan. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is the new interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs, Rachel Hartley. Our engineer is David Kesters. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Carly Meisberger. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio and a review of the 2018 congressional elections. At 9, Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Between the Covers. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, conversations with animators and pioneering comic artists. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. Thanks for listening to the evening news. Good night, Aaron.
Good night, Carly.
Good night, David.
Now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Hello, hello, folks, and welcome to News from the Boo. This is your weekly update about what's going on in and around KBOO, and I am Delphine Crescenzo. I'm your host this evening, and I'm super excited to introduce to you Rachel Hartley, our news director. And the previous folks during the news says that maybe she was interim, but no, she's not interim. Rachel is the news director, and yes. This is her second week.
This is only week two.
Yes. Yeah. So welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
And welcome to News from the Boo. Let's start by talking about your passion about radio. Would you tell us about that and what brought you to KBOO?
I have had a long passion for radio. I had a wonderful family and friends who always turned on the radio for me when I was a little kid. I used to nap to the smooth jazz 105.9 here in Portland, and I was really devastated when they ended it, because it was like one of my first initial starts of my love for radio. 1480, 107.5, which used to be 95.5, Kink FM. So I was a radio head for sure. I'll never forget, for one of my birthdays, I got a solar radio and I would lay it out in the sun and like wind it up. And I was like, not only am I being sustainable, but I get to hear all my favorite radio stations. So, and I always knew that I wanted to do stuff like this. I think that my experience with radio, even in college and things like that, probably brought me here to KBOO, and the universe just brought me here, and I'm really happy to be here. I still can't believe it's happening, but I'm doing the best that I can, and that's what makes me happy.
Yeah, you're absolutely doing great. So you were born and raised in Portland.
Would you
tell us a little bit about growing up here and then coming back here after college, and what you've seen has changed?
Yeah, growing up here was very interesting. It's much different now than it was when I was a kid. It wasn't as popular when I was a kid. Portland was really small, and we used to joke about how artists would come from California, skip over Portland, and then go to Seattle to do their performances, and that was just it. You know, we had the Blazers, but like, you know, we weren't that on top of our game as we are now. Mm-hmm. So it was a different place. And so as a kid, I really had to, you know, figure out ways to entertain myself, because there just wasn't any like fun activities for kids unless you went to like Oaks Park or like the bowling alleys and things like that. So there was a lot of room for creativity and you know, expressing that, and that was Portland back in the day.
And how do you see it change now?
It's very white, to be frank.
Please be frank.
It's it's very white. It's kind of sad, because you know, a lot, as everyone knows, gentrification has hit the city, and a lot of people of color are not here, and they don't reside here. They live in outside towns, such as like East Portland and things like that. But a lot of those people who live there used to own businesses here, used to have housing here. So I'm not too proud of the Portland that is today, but I want to be a part of letting everyone know that it's not okay that it's this way, and how can we work together to make it different?
Right, because it is it is that displacement, right? Of you know, people used to have businesses, and people used to be in community here, go to church here, go to school here, and be active here.
Yeah.
Would you talk a little bit about the importance of the legacy of Black activism in Portland?
Yeah, I believe that my activism is on brand for myself, because my family has a long history of Black activism here in the city, from my grandfather owning a Black oil company, from my other family members owning their own businesses that pertained solely for Black people. And that's where I get my inspiration from, is that fight to keep Portland Black, that fight to keep Portland available for people of color. And I think that my activism just like flourished when I moved to California. And I really found myself there. And then coming back here, it was a huge disappointment. But I was like, you know what? I'm supposed to serve my community. Mm. So I'm not going to assimilate to this new Portland. I'm going to keep it real with the Portland that I've been raised by and come back and let everybody know that I'm here to make a difference through my activism, and that's through radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so talk a little bit about your activism back in California. What are some of the work that you've done with community organizing?
Oh, goodness. That is a long list.
I know, but from what I understand, you were very involved with the Black Student Union at the college and were part of organizing some of the very first Black Lives Matters protest on the St. Mary's campus. So would you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I just want to shout out to all my friends who are listening. They were a part of those movements for sure. And I was really afraid, especially because I was going to a predominantly white institution. Mm. And I thought, well, anything could happen. They could kick me out. I could lose my scholarship at like any moment, you know, because of this. And not to shade St. Mary's College or anything, but like I feel like it's a fear of Black students who are activists anyway. You know, you don't know what's going to happen if you step out, and you have to step out on faith and hope that you'll be okay after you decide to make your voice be heard. So we started with die-ins in the dining hall. We started with protesting during finals week. We were protesting. I remember an epic protest where we shut down a jazz concert and we made a parent very upset that we were interrupting her child's
performance.
But, you know, social justice doesn't stop for anyone, and I think that was our fuel to the fire to keep going even if we make people upset. So we had another movement called In the Silence, which was even more epic as well, because it was to have more diversity conversations with staff and faculty because students didn't feel safe in class. And so how are we going to change the system in order to make professors go through diversity training through our intercultural center on campus? So that was a big deal. And a lot of us were labeled as, you know, those angry kids at SMC. Why don't they just go somewhere else? Mm-hmm. But we were like, that's not what activism is. It's loving where you're at and being willing to fight for it because you want it to be better for somebody else.
Right.